Hello and welcome to Talking Euretina, the official podcast of the European Society of Retina Specialists. I'm Jonathan McRae. In this podcast, we bring you expert discussions and interviews with leaders from the world of retina and beyond. We also keep you up to date with the latest news from the Society. In this episode, we're going to take a look at visual function deficits in intermediate AMD. But before we hear from our faculty, a note that submissions for results of clinical trials and the late-breaking sessions are now being accepted for this year's Euretina Congress. Deadline for those is Wednesday, 19th of June. You can find more information and register, of course, for Euretina Barcelona 2024 at euretina.org. Now, on to our discussion. We're delighted to welcome back Professor Frank Holtz from the University of Bonn to speak with Ms. Hannah Dunbar, Principal Optometrist at Moorfields and University College London, about assessing function in intermediate AMD. Frank, it's great to have you back on. I hope you're well. Over to you.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. It's a great pleasure to join this podcast for EU Retina, and it's an even more pleasure and honor to have Dr. Dunbar with us today, and world expert in assessing functional characteristics of the retina in various diseases, but specifically in age-related macular disease. So Hannah, may I be starting off with a question? You heavily engaged in the so-called MacuStar study. What this is all about?
Thanks, Frank, and thanks so much for inviting me to speak today. So MacuStar is a European study, 20 sites across Europe, 7 different countries. And in that study, we're really interested in understanding what outcomes we might be able to use for future interventional trials in intermediate AMD. And that's going to cover structural endpoints, functional endpoints, which I'm mostly interested in, and also patient-reported outcome measures.
And so the purpose of the exercise is, are there not enough clinical endpoints, validated endpoints around that we are used to in late-stage AMD? How is it in intermediate AMD?
Well, as you know, in function, we only really have one validated endpoint at the moment, that being visual acuity or best corrected visual acuity. And what we notice in AMD and in other conditions, we don't get a large enough change in best corrected visual acuity in those earlier and intermediate stages. And so that, to some extent, precludes its use as a good endpoint. So we're really looking to see if there are other functional measures that might track change better, be more accurate, and also be more meaningful to patients. Because you mentioned at the beginning, I'm also an optometrist in clinic, and we'll often see people with quite good acuity, but who have lots and lots of complaints. And they will often say things like, oh, the doctor told me I'm fine. You know, I still see the same on the chart, but they're very much convinced that they're not seeing the same in their day-to-day life. So I think it's both a question of endpoints that are more sensitive, but also more meaningful to the patient experience.
Excellent. So you're telling about patients, plenty of complaints. Also, the retina looks overall fine. And I think we're used to thinking of late stage AMD, be it atrophic or neovascular AMD, with massive visual impairment, but not so much in this intermediate stage. And you just told best corrected visual acuity may not tell anything. So what functional impairment do you see in this intermediate AMD patients, and how does this correlate to their complaints?
Well, if I can just flip it the other direction, if that's okay. I mean, in clinic, the things that people would typically complain of are issues around changing light levels or low light levels, and also low contrast. And my heart slightly sinks when I see these patients, because it's actually quite difficult in a low vision setting to help them. Because other than saying things like maximizing light, you know, maximizing contrast, making choices that will maximize those conditions, there's nothing I can give them that is going to just resolve that problem straight away for them. In terms of the MacuStar study, we've been really lucky that we've been able to test a wide range of visual function measures to capture vision in these circumstances. So looking at things like low luminance visual acuity, where we're measuring visual acuity under low luminance conditions, the Moorfields acuity test, which is a vanishing optotype type test, which is good around things like contrast, also Pelli-Robson contrast sensitivity, reading speed. Reading is of utmost importance to lots and lots of our patients. And we also look at retinal sensitivity in mesopic and scotopic conditions, so dim light in very dim conditions or very dark conditions, and also rod intercept time, so a person's ability to adapt to the dark, essentially. And when we do that in MacuStar, we actually see that you get a really wide spread of functional measures across these different tests that we do. And we were lucky that we were also able to collect some data from people who have no macular degeneration, so similar age profile to those who have the condition, but who do not display any disease. And we can compare our results in intermediate AMD to them. And what you actually find is that though you can tease out very small differences between the function of these groups, on the whole or on average, it's actually very small. But there are a proportion of people with intermediate AMD who actually have function as poor as those who have the much later stage of disease. So I think what it's been showing us is that to classify everybody with intermediate AMD, which as you know is defined structurally, as having similar function doesn't tell the full story at all. And so when we do that, we actually see that there are significant groups of people with intermediate AMD that complain of those very things we mentioned, things like low luminance vision problems, contrast vision problems, dark adaptation problems, that have very poor function.
Thank you, Hannah. That's very telling. And you mentioned that's a structurally based classification system, what we call early, intermediate, and late stage AMD. And it looks as if this basket of intermediate AMD encompasses a lot of subphenotypes. So I understand you find structural related visual deficits not in all of these intermediate AMD patients, but in fractions of patients. So what rough proportions do you see?
So in terms of function, we have a cohort of nearly 600 people with intermediate AMD. And as I mentioned earlier, they're doing 8 different visual function tests. So what we've done there is look at how many have impaired function on those tests. So we see about 30% don't have any impairment. They sail through all 8 tests, do really well. And then we see about 70% who have poor function on at least one of these tests. Now, it's probably more sensible to extend that to how many people have at least 2 deficits or who perform poorly on 2 tests. And that's just over 40%. So there really is, you know, a decent proportion of people who we wouldn't be able to say, you know, have essentially normal function.
And you mentioned earlier, and these are patients you detect these visual deficits, but they may have 20/20 vision or 6/6 vision. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, we look at the visual deficits across all of the different tests. The predominant test that we find in isolation being impaired is actually a rod intercept time. So, you know, people who are really slowly adapting to the dark, whereas otherwise their function is good. And the second most likely test to be impaired on is contrast sensitivity. So again, back to those two, you know, those two patient complaints that we mentioned.
So you mentioned dark adaptation problems, and the measure for this is rod intercept time. Would you be scared of driving with somebody in the car who has this deficit entering a tunnel and exit a tunnel perhaps?
I don't know if I'd be scared per se, but these are the complaints that people will have. So certainly when they're going from those light to dark to light environments, they'll often say things like, even when they're out walking, so if they're going from shade into bright into shade again, people, the hikers, you know, the people who are in forest conditions often say that, especially if they've got any obstacles in front of them, roots of trees, that type of thing. But yeah, I mean, we're always counseling our patients on the importance of light in general as they get older, but certainly this population would complain more.
Mm-hmm. So do you give practical recommendations how they make up their living room, for example, need a better light? Is that something that would help them?
I mean, that's something that we do really standardly in a low vision practice in general. So having really, you know, good task lighting, lower than eye level, so you're not getting too much glare from it, shining directly rather than obliquely, so you're not getting any glare. Talking about things like when's the best time to put your sunglasses on. So if you know you're about to head out into a very bright sunny day, pop your sunglasses on just before you leave so you don't get that big bleaching effect of a lot of light hitting your eyes and then having to adapt. So things like that. But yeah, I mean, as I said in the beginning, it's a tricky one because there's no easy answer for these things. You know, we can't just make it go away and be better.
Interesting. And I understand Macustar also uses fundus control perimetry called microperimetry. What are the advantages of using this particular test? We do understand that clinical sites and physicians may not love this test because it's also from the patient's view quite tedious if you have several spots tested for retinal sensitivity. How do you see this fit to capture visual deficits in patients with intermediate AMD?
Yeah, so microperimetry or fundus control perimetry has been around, you know, a decent amount of time now. And the tests have gotten better. They've, you know, gotten quicker and more comfortable for patients. But essentially what it's doing is like a mini field test in that macular area, but it's a fundus control, so it's tracked. So as you can imagine, patients with macular degeneration have poorer central vision, may find it very difficult to fixate a fixation target in a test. And all of us, our eye, even with good fixation, our eye will make sort of micro little fixational movements. So the benefit of microperimetry is it will be able to track the eye position. And when you present a repeated stimulus, it's going to hit the same part of the retina that it did the first time round, even if your eye is moving. And the other thing is it's going to give us this sort of heat map or sensitivity map over that macular region. So it's not just, you know, a single measure, it's a topographic measure. It'll give us that sort of hill of vision type of measure. So we can see whether someone has good retinal sensitivity across the macula, or if they have poorer sensitivity across, or if they have these depressions and elevations and, you know, sort of more patchy loss of retinal function. So it does tell us a lot more than, say, again, BCVA, where, you know, I could nearly train a person to get a better BCVA score just by watching how they read the chart in terms of counseling them for their eccentric viewing position. And that's part of, you know, working in low vision specifically. But it can just show me how much the, you know, the experience of the technician doing the BCVA measurement can actually really influence or have a role in how well the person does that test. Whereas with microperimetry, it should be much more objective. But you're right that patients don't always love this test. They have to stay quite still. They have to, you know, respond to these lights. And even just like in perimetry, you know, it's not that nice to be watching this dark screen and not sure whether you've seen the stimuli or not. Luckily in MacuStar, our protocol takes about 5 to 6 minutes. So it's not, you know, really, really long. But if you couple that up with all the other tests we do, of course, we have to keep in mind that patient burden for sure. Mm-hmm.
So you would see the potential using microperimetry in future interventional trials to test efficacy, to test effects of an agent in terms of improving or halting decline of visual deficit?
Yeah, I wouldn't rule it out for sure. I mean, in MacuStar, we've got 20 centers. We've got multiple technicians at these centers. You know, and on the lifespan of a study, obviously technicians will turn over. You'll have to train more people. And we've been able to, you know, write up a decent SOP and test how well the technicians are able to adhere to that and the quality of the data that comes through. And actually, I personally was really pleasantly surprised at how, you know, all our sites did. And you know, we really congratulate the technicians for their involvement there. So I think in a clinical trial, also thinking that we would be unlikely to be doing the whole 8 tests that we obviously do at MacuStar, that would make it easier as well, because, you know, we're not asking people to do functional testing for 2 hours in their appointment. So, yeah, I honestly wouldn't rule it out at all.
Very interesting. You mentioned earlier structural characteristics of intermediate AMD. Did you find any structure function correlations? We're all always seeking for that, and it turns out often to not be as black and white as we wish. Did you see structure changes, say, on optic coherence tomography that went along with rather more visual deficits than in the absence of the structural feature?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the main one was really RPD presence. We do tend to get that overlap.
And RPD stands for?
Reticular pseudodrusen.
Yes, and sometimes called subretinal drusenoid deposits, SDDs. Yeah. Thank you.
But yes, we tended to see it go hand in hand there more so. And also in MacuStar, we've been able to look at how these functional measures change over time. And we also see that those with RPD tend to have, you know, a greater change in function over time as well. Mm-hmm. I think, to be honest, there's more work to do in that space within MacuStar, because as you can imagine, you know, we have a lot of data and a lot of different structural parameters to look at. But we're really lucky to have a really great team working on that as well at MacuStar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I understand there's a toolbox, not only of function assessments, but also of structure probing and then finding out what would turn out best as a clinical endpoint for future studies. Now, a huge unmet medical need is obviously preventing or slowing the conversion from intermediate AMD to late stage AMD. I understand this is one of the goals of finding endpoints with this regard. Could you imagine also clinical trials? You mentioned these patients who have massive deficits just in this stage of intermediate AMD to perhaps improve vision for them. So a very different, perhaps very different study design and treatment goal.
I think it's definitely worth something to think about. I mean, I think I wouldn't necessarily be the expert on, you know, different modes of actions of particular drugs coming along that might be able to, you know, alleviate some of these functional deficits. But I think the important thing to start from is to sort of convince regulators, the community, that these deficits in intermediate AMD are of clinical relevance. Because I think a lot of us still feel as though intermediate AMD, you know, the person's got decent BCVA and therefore they're ultimately still okay and there's not a deficit there worth treating. And of course, you have to weigh up the sort of risk benefit to any, you know, potential treatment there. But yeah, I mean, I think it would be fantastic if that was the you know, the end goal, that you could actually prevent or reverse some of this functional deterioration. But I mean, I think to start with, the kind of obvious way to implement some of these findings that we've had in MacuStar is to help with, say, recruitment into trials to prevent the progression to late AMD. Because in theory, if we know that these functional deficits are signifiers of people who progress more quickly, which is what we've been able to show in MacuStar, then we could enrich these clinical trial populations, essentially recruiting on the basis of people having these functional deficits at baseline.
Yeah, so enrichment would obviously help in a relatively slowly progressing disease to make a trial less costly and have not such long observation periods, which seems key, obviously. I understand in MacuStar you also engage with the regulators, with EMA and FDA. What's the take of EMA of the MacuStar project?
Well, we've been lucky to have a few interactions with EMA and, as you say, FDA across the study. And they're generally very supportive of our protocols and our approaches. And we have presented this concept of functional deficit in intermediate AMD. At our first presentation of it, they were very interested and sort of highlighted that if these deficits did help identify those who would progress to late disease, that that would strengthen their clinical significance. And in our most recent interaction, we've been able to present that data to them as well. So I think in general, they were quite supportive.
So regulators are at the table and are discussing with the MacuStar project. I understand it's the largest funding for private-public partnership in the European Union for the first part of the funding. So industry is also engaged. I understand they have a huge interest in coming forward with clinical endpoints so they can test their drugs.
So in the MacuStar Consortium, we're really lucky to be able to work with clinical partners, academic partners, and industry partners like Zeiss, Bayer, Novartis, and Roche. And it's been my first experience of working in such a consortium, and I've really been pleasantly surprised at that really high, tight collaboration between all of the partners. And what's been really great is that these three pharma companies have actually provided additional funding so that we can follow our patients up for a longer period of time. So initially, we plan to follow them up for 3 years. But now we're in a position to follow up for 6 years, which will be really great. We'll be able to look at the trajectory of functional, structural, and patient-reported outcome measures over that longer period of time. And also, unfortunately for the patients, we will see more conversion events to late AMD, but that will then allow us to hopefully understand the markers of, you know, what makes a person progress into that late stage disease.
Well, Hannah, thank you so much. That has been extremely insightful and a lot of learnings there. And you mentioned in your last sentence, it's the conversion to late AMD that we want to prevent. We all know that treating late stage disease, we have now first drugs for atrophic AMD, anti-VEGFs and others for wet AMD, but not to have to treat them would, of course, be a huge help to the health system, to patients, to physicians. So I think it's a very important goal to come forward and address these unmet needs, specifically in intermediate AMD. Again, thank you so much, Hannah. That's been fantastic.
Great. Thanks, Frank. Bye.
Jonathan, back to you.
Excellently done, as always. Frank, thank you very much for that. And of course, thank you to you, Dr. Dunbar, for your contribution. We will be returning to the subject of intermediate AMD in a couple of months' time. But if you would like us to cover anything on the podcast, do let us know, podcast@uretina.org, and we will do our very best to cover it for you. That's it from us on this week's episode. I'm Jonathan McRae. We'll see you next time on Talking Uretina.